fellow Canadians, fellow Korean, fellow Norwegian, fellow Americans, and fellow villagers from Minneapolis and Seattle. This is a great day. There has never been a celebration such as this throughout Canada. 100 years since the Act of Confederation. There's never been the celebration of the Act of Confederation at Holden Village either before. So you're in on something absolutely unique. There's never been anything like it in your life before. Those of you who keep diaries, be sure to mark this down tonight. But this is very special. Put a rim of red around this page. I don't know who can speak properly on this occasion. Who is qualified to speak on such an occasion? I don't know why I was asked. I wasn't born in Canada. I'm not a Canadian. I wasn't living in 1867. It may be that for this reason I can speak very objectively. I'm not a Canadian subject, therefore I won't speak subjectively, you see. I'm unburdened by involvement, participation, and I have no freight of knowledge to carry along with me. So I can do this very easily. I tried to figure out, Carol was manufacturing some things there, as to why I should do this. I can say, however, I'm rather proud of this. My maternal grandfather came from Demarest, Ontario. Our shack in the North Woods is 10 miles from the Canadian border. I'm from Minnesota. Minnesota is the northernmost part of the United States. Northernmost part. Note that, anybody from Maine. It only looks farther up on the map, but the northwest angle juts up into Canada. I attended the exposition, Expo 1967, and here I want you to know that the world is divided. I once thought there were two kinds of people in the world, those who wet their toothbrush before brushing their teeth, before putting the toothpaste on, those who wet the toothbrush after putting the toothpaste on. Then a logician from the University of Cincinnati pointed out there are some who don't brush their teeth. But here's a watertight one. And I tell you, in Canada, this is true. You meet anybody, have you been to Expo? You just must have been to the exposition, you see. Otherwise, you don't talk to people. You just go around in the darkness of the night and slink in alleys, you see. There are just two kinds of people in the world. And I belong to that one kind, you see, those who have. I also, together with Theodore, took a marvelous journey. I recommend it to you. From the Atlantic coast, oh, I'll admit it was a big indentation of the St. Lawrence there, but it goes up, you know, not only to Quebec, but up to Montreal. You can take an ocean-going ship from Montreal. But a 3,200-mile railroad journey through the north middle part, that is the CNR route, way to the Pacific coast, from the Italian-speaking part of Canada, through the Dutch-speaking part, the Norwegian-speaking part, way out to the Chinese-speaking part of Canada. And then there are some little cliques there who speak French and English. Furthermore, to really give you my qualifications, I had research assistants on this job. Really, I had a splendid 6-hour on into the night conversation about all kinds of things, philosophy, cooking, and Canada, with the new second cook of the potash mine 30 miles north of Red Lake Road in northwest Ontario. Now, he told me a lot of things, so I really have something to go on. I'm telling you this also in order to shift the blame if at any point I seem to have been smoking pot or seem to be making an ash of myself. Now, even that I'm not responsible for. Mr. Karl Marx Scott told me that this is the motto, really, of the Los Angeles Fire Department. Don't make an ash of yourself. Now, if there is anyone here who has better qualifications than I have, let him speak. Otherwise, hold your peace. You may, however, in holding your peace, at appropriate points, wave your handkerchief. I want to say something about Canada on 5 points. Each point has 2 sub-points. That makes 10. Some of them may have a point or two more, so that makes 11 or more. This explains this thing up here. The Canadians developed this insignia for this year as a symbol for my talk. 10 or more points, you see. The first main point is discovery. The second is development. The third is relationship to the United States. The fourth is achievement. And the fifth, the future. Now, if there are historically minded people who don't care about the future, you may leave after the first point. What about discovery of Canada? Omitting those who are there and acting as, what do you call them, Don? What are they called here now? The Hospitality Committee? Omitting the Eskimos and the Indians who acted as the Hospitality Committee, we find these people mentioned as the discoverers of Canada. The British claim that John and Sebastian Cabot discovered Canada in 1497. They ignore Columbus because they said that he hadn't reached the mainland. He didn't reach the mainland in 1492. And furthermore, that Columbus never reached the mainland of the mainland. Therefore, he's of no importance with regard to the discovery of Canada. Verrazzano, a Florentine under the French flag, came to the French coast in 1524 and called it Nouvelle France. Jacques Cartier in 1534, impressive, isn't it? 1534, explored the whole East Coast. So you get the British and the French talking about these British and the French who discovered and explored Canada. But actually, all these Jackies and Johnnies are come latelys, you see. Because, after all, generations before these fellows came, there were Norwegians. Well, you needn't laugh. Any fool knows that. Now, I want to document that for you, in case there are any skeptics or other people whose names begin with S. Let's put it all under the heading of Leif Erikson, because there are a lot of them who came, actually. There are lots of them who came. One of the fascinating things, very fascinating things of the last few years, has been the discovery of town sites in Newfoundland, which are indisputably early Norwegian town sites. Helge Ingstad, using the sagas and following the sagas very strictly. He said they actually sailed using the description of the land according to the way it was given in certain sagas and some of the Eddas. And so there's a place. And lo and behold, they dug and there it was. And they found not only that site, but other sites. And last year, the Vinland map was the biggest publication of the Yale University Press. And European newspapers, I don't know how it was here, we were in Denmark at the time, they made a lot of it. That's an amazing thing. It wasn't that these Norwegians were tongue-tied when they got home. Actually, maps were made on the basis of it. It's a very enormous historical puzzle. There are those, of course, who say that Columbus actually knew about this, from this kind of thing. Well, that's one thing. Then, of course, for those who are still skeptical, there is the Kensington Runestone at Alexandria, Minnesota. Now, there are those who say, well, that was actually made by a Swedish farmer who buried it under a tree. And then years later, got some of the neighbors to help him, you know, and then they discover this thing. Just like the, the Cardiff Giant years ago that Barnum and Bailey had, you know, dug up in New York. Well, this argument against the Kensington Runestone is false, untenable, just on the face of it. What Swede would be smart enough to think of that? But now, if you don't go for diggings, if you don't go for maps, if you don't go for runestones, if you're of the sort of literary, linguistic type, there is the impenetrable argument from language. This has to do with the now well-established fact that a strain of the Norwegians is actually the residue of one of the lost tribes of Israel. You can see this, there is that type called black Norwegians. You know them, you've seen them. I mean, they are black. I mean, they're dark. They can't do a thing about it. They don't get in the sun, but they're very dark. They look like North Africans, you see. And the linguistic aspect of this can be traced this way. Centuries and centuries ago, as the Hebrews celebrated around the fires at night, they would chant. Now, I don't want to go into all the Old Testament aspect of these things. I know all about it, but some of you might not be able to follow my use of the Hebrew and all, but Yahweh, you see. And they chanted Jehovah or Yahweh or Yahweh, you see. And this was burned into their consciousness. It was part of their very beings. Then as they were cast out into the world, they wandered and wandered. They came to India. Now in India, the great sacred word, which can't even be said, that is just in speech, O-M, Om, it must be chanted, you see. So here is something not the same, but similar to this Yahweh. Well, then they went on, got into Norway, lived there, settled, became part of the people. Then came the big migration in the 19th century. Well, of course, there's earlier, as I pointed out before, Leif Erikson and so on, but we're talking about the later migration now. And they came by the hundreds and the thousands and the tens of thousands, just as did the Irish and the Germans and many others, and settled in various parts of the United States. And there is in one area, in north-central United States, this linguistic trace of this lost tribe of Israel. And there will be at times in southern Minnesota at a place called Manitou Heights, where on special occasions you will hear this blended chant, Om Ya Ya, Om Ya Ya, Om Ya Ya, Om Ya Ya. Om ya ya, om ya ya, om ya ya ya. We are from St. Olaf, we sure are the. So much for discovery. Except just to say, if it hadn't been discovered, we wouldn't be here today celebrating. 100th anniversary of the Act of Confederation. Now, what about development? There are sections here. Let's say before 1867. That can be tied up, in this way. The French were there. The British came. The Governor General sent a cable to the King of France saying, "Our general is losing his calm." They just don't know enough history, do they? Then he sent another cable saying, "We have lost Quebec." And in 1763, the French ceded Canada to Great Britain. A very significant thing, extremely significant thing about that then and now and for the future, was that the French colonists were guaranteed free exercise of the Roman Catholic religion. And the Quebec Act of 1774 prescribed that French laws, royal edicts, etc., were binding. And that is all these things relative to civil and property rights were binding. The British or English jury system, however, superseded the French criminal law. There were at that time two parts of Canada, one called Upper Canada, which was really British, and Lower Canada, which was French. Canada was a name for these two parts. They were separate. And then there were the certain other provinces, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Newfoundland, and then the vast territories, which one writer said were abandoned to the Hudson's Bay Company. But there were difficulties between Upper Canada, British, and Lower Canada, France, or French, that is French culture, French speaking. And there were calls for some kind of union, particularly of these two parts and also these other British provinces. The American Civil War was of real importance in the joining of these various units because, as one writer said, common dangers to which they were exposed by the results springing out of the Great American Civil War gave added motives for such a union. We never think of our having promoted this confederation of Upper and Lower Canada and the British provinces. In 1867, there was an imperial act called the British North American Act, which provided for the voluntary union of the whole of British North America in one legislative confederation to be called, and here this name was taken from the two parts then, Upper and Lower Canada, the Dominion of Canada. There are a lot of interesting things, but we'll skip over that and come to point three. That is relationship to the United States. It's very fascinating to read a history written somewhere else. Who was mentioning that yesterday? Was that Carol? Or who mentioned that? Something about how histories get written, the nationalism of histories. If anything, with regard to the loyalists, we read in our histories that some of those sneakers, those bums, went off in the dark of the night up north, you see, up to what was then called Upper Canada. But the British writings on Canada say quite a bit about the loyal Britishers who came into Canada in the 1770s. That's one aspect of the relationship of the United States, or that the southern colonies, to Canada. Another interesting item was the attempt during the beginning of the Revolutionary War to take Canada. And around Quebec, you'll see all kinds of plaques honoring British companies who repulsed, if you please now, Benedict Arnold and the American forces who tried to take Quebec, you see, for the colonies to the south. Later on, there's another interesting item which I don't remember reading about in any American history, but it's a little item that promoted Canada, even though the United States was not trying to promote Canada at the time. The U.S. had a reciprocity treaty with Canada, which lasted from 1854 to 1866. And the United States abrogated that treaty in the hope that by restricting the ports of Boston, New York, and a few others, that there would be created a desire for annexation to the United States. But the results were just the opposite. And this is one of the most important influences in the economic independence of Canada. Whereas for 6 years before 1866, there was an enormous trade imbalance in the favor of the United States with regard to French-Canadian trade. In a few years after the United States tried to put the pressure on Canada, there was an imbalance in favor of Canada. And Canada started dealing in world trade directly instead of going through New York or U.S. ports and U.S. firms. Now, I mention this because we do make a lot of what is on this poster, this matter of peace between Canada and the United States, this matter of friendship. I say I make something of this because, frankly, I don't know what to make of some of the words in O Canada, which we shall sing a little later, unless you remember that not all was so rosy between Canada, that southern part of North America, and the northern part, and northern and southern parts. The word is guard. The word appears 5 times in that song. It's the key word. We will guard you, O Canada, you see. Against what? Well, against the United States, the southern colonies, certainly during the Revolutionary War, certainly with regard to certain economic pressures. Now, at this time, the Canadians are still on guard a little bit. They're on guard against U.S. economic domination. This is a tender point. They want U.S. capital, but they don't want to be dominated by U.S. companies. They are on guard against U.S. cultural domination. There's a splendid book on education by Hilda Neatby, a professor of history at the University of Saskatchewan. The title is So Little for the Mind. Why does she use that title with regard to education? Because many Canadians are afraid of American influences on Canadian education, and they see American education as having very little for the mind, and they would like to keep something which they think they have. Furthermore, they are on guard against a kind of American international political domination. They don't want to be told how to view things in the world. They want to have their own minds. They have the notion that Carol Hinderly was talking about, and talking about women. Carol thinks women ought to speak once in a while. Well, the Canadians think that even though they're small and young, that they ought to be able to speak and speak for themselves. Now, what about the achievements? I could dwell on a lot of things with regard to Canadian achievements. I could emphasize, for example, Canadian assistance to undeveloped countries, poor countries. We have one symbol of that in the discount on the dollar that the Canadians give to the United States in order to help us out. And remember, if you please, the Canadians have the only silver dollar that is a silver dollar. Try to get a silver dollar in the United States. You can't even get a silver certificate. And now they've pulled back their promise to pay silver for those too just last week, didn't they? I could say something about Expo 67, universally acclaimed as the finest World's Fair ever put on. Except for a disclaimer by some Americans who have seen the American exhibit. I frankly think it's a pleasant joke myself. But if you're not ready to take a pleasant joke at the cost of $20 million, you may not laugh. A lot of politicians, you'll hear more about this fall. Yeah. But I think it's a very pleasant joke and perhaps worth it. They just sold the building for $1, one Canadian dollar, I think it was, silver dollar, to the city of Montreal. I could say something about the Canadian flag. No other country has it. No country can make that statement. There are lots of achievements. I could mention 1,000 of them. Let me just give you a sample. Let me take one of the smallest, I suppose the smallest group in all of Canada. And then just take this, the achievements of this little group and multiply it, you see, by I don't know how many. Square it, cube it, hundredfold. That is the Eskimos. Canadian Eskimos, the achievements of colon. Take, for example, in the sphere of gastronomy. Stand up. Children, what is the finest confection ever made? What is the finest dessert? Eskimo pies, of course. Now I'll have to ask the experts here, the real experts, what is the finest salad? Salad green in the world. I won't put you on the spot after this fine dinner. It's escarole.
Escarole.
Yes. In the world of invention, ladies and gentlemen, invention. After all, this is a mechanized world, mechanized coffee pots, mechanized speakers, mechanized recorders, mechanized tapeworms, all kinds of things. Thank you, Don. He was just hissing because I didn't give the footnote and give him credit. You go to these big stores, you wait for elevators, you know, you stand and stand and stand and the light is on and all. Well, what did the Eskimos do? The escalator, of course. And in the U.S. exhibit at Expo 67, you know what the greatest trouble was? It was the escalators. Actually, they're having lots of trouble with them. And you know why? Because they had some American mechanics there, full-time, full-pay, to take care of this Eskimo invention, when they should have had experts. Now let's move to another realm. Take the world, we're dominated by the military. We're told, and it's a frightening, horrible thought, which it is terrible. 80% of our U.S. income tax goes for war. Past, present, future. So we're dominated by the military. Large part of which goes to Air Force. Personnel, planes, new planes. What is this plane that a lot of trouble about, you know? Excuse me, Renton people. You want me to say there's trouble, I guess, don't you? But how did these air forces really get off the ground, these military air forces? It all happened because of a particular group, the most spectacular group during World War I. That is the Lafayette Escadrille. All Eskimos. You know, it used to be in my classes I could make references to the Bible, to Sears Roebuck, you know, things like that. Things that happened as late as 1950. Well, you older people. But now, all of you, whatever your age, at least if you've been doing what you're supposed to be doing, if you've been going to school over here in the mornings, you've been learning a bit of theology. And there's one, not only one word, but one whole sphere that certain men have been emphasizing. Carol Hinderly emphasized it today. Bowman emphasized it yesterday as a whole key to the understanding of Christianity and everything else. This is a sheer product of the Eskimos. Obviously, eschatology. Oh, now listen. This goes way back. If you really are, be patient now, if you really want to get at the philology of this, you see, esk or eski or eska means last or final, you see. And you get it in another, it's changed a little bit in the Greek, you see, so you get eschatology, last things. But the whole point is, this comes from the very name of the Eskimos. You see, that is that they are the ones who are the last ones. They are the farthest out, you see. That is, there ain't no more. Therefore, Eskimo. Now, we do have to go further, make another little distinction here. I've spoken of the Eskimos as one group, a small group, yet they are large enough to be divided, and you should, those of you who travel, and people travel so much, and I know you're fascinated now by Canadian Eskimos after tonight, and we'll go that way. There are the northern Eskimos, who are more esky than the southern Eskimos, you see, because they're more farther out. You can, if you have linguistic sensitivity, it's a matter of ear. You have to learn languages if you're going to get around in this world. And if you can listen, you can distinguish the northern Eskimos from those who are a little farther south. The northern Eskimos talk something like this. Glub, 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 glub. Isn't that right? And those farther south say, glub, 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 you all. Now, if the Eskimos can do all of this and more that I haven't mentioned, just think of what all Canada and all of these other groups in Canada have done in these areas and in other areas. You have to think of it this way, Beanie, Gertrude, and others, Bergendorf's. You have to think of it this way. Remember that wonderful old story about the Swedish immigrant who was coming to this country? He'd heard about Kansas. He'd heard about Lindsborg, Kansas. And he got off the boat, looked around New York and said, if New York is like this, what must Lindsborg be? So if the Eskimos are like this, have done all this, what must all of Canada have done? Now, what about the future? For some years, I and a number of other people were working with displaced persons and refugees. Ross Heide was over there at that time. And when it came to emigrating, those who didn't have some particular relationship which made their emigration to a certain point not only feasible, but a much greater possibility for them, many of us advised, go to Canada or Australia. Why? I think there is something to be said about Canada, and Australia too, but Canada now. That is, that there is individual possibility in Canada. Dutch farmers are still coming into Canada without a penny. And in 10 years, have a $50,000 farm. How does a young man start farming in Washington, in Minnesota? I frankly don't know how he can, you see. Really start farming. Borrow $50,000, $60,000. I mean, it takes enormous capital to begin farming. You people, city slickers, think farming is simple. Well, maybe it was, but now you can't start. In Canada, you can. There is individual possibility. You remember the old saying about what happens when a Greek meets Greek? They start a restaurant, you see. Well, what happens with an Italian? The Italians are the second largest group coming into Canada at the present time. All an Italian has to do to start a restaurant is to find one onion, and he's in business. He can do it. There is possibility in Canada, as well as all kinds of work, yes, but there is an openness. But there's something else in Canada, and I speak very seriously in this category of number five, and that is there's a cultural pluralism in Canada, something that we don't have in the United States. We've had a cultural pluralism. Now we go so far that all we have left of it is that we can have fun making jokes about the Swedes and the Germans and the Norwegians and so on. The price of this, for example, in education, is a monolithic educational system. There's no place in the world outside of the Soviet Union, as far as I know, that in one sense is as hostile to cultural pluralism as the United States, and epitomized in the educational system. So that if the Roman Catholics or if the French Catholics are concerned about their cultural religious values, they are forced to pay double, you see. They are taxed twice. This isn't true in Canada. In Quebec, larger cities will have a Protestant school board. They'll have their schools. There will be a Roman Catholic school board, and there can be a third one if it's large enough for all of those who want a non-religious educational system. This is very important, this cultural pluralism within a national unity. You get this cultural pluralism in another way. It's fascinating, I think, and that is the neighborhoods. Now, we have a few of them left, but they're almost sort of tourist attractions now in the United States, you know, the Amish and some of this, certain parts of Pennsylvania and places like Rock Island and so on. But in Canada, you go to Calgary, for example, and there'll be two, three blocks that are really a Hungarian world. In Vancouver, just walking an hour, I discovered this marvelous Chinatown there. It's terrific. I think it's all that it is in San Francisco, you see. I mean, these things disappear. Chinatown in New York has almost evaporated. You have to ask people, really, is this it? Otherwise, you'll walk through it and not know it. Well, these are some wonderful things. The world of possibility. I think the future of Canada is one of individual and group possibility. It's a kind of last frontier, along with Alaska in another sense, a lesser sense, in the North American continent. So having celebrated Canada under these five headings, I now invite you to sing. Celebrate by singing the first stanza and the chorus of O Canada. The first stanza and the chorus of O Canada. Will you stand up?
Thank you, Dr. Hong. I haven't heard such subtle humor since I've left Canada.